and he is not going to be able to deliver anything. Behind him, it's the army.
I wanted to go to what's happening in France. Tens of thousands of people took to the streets Saturday protesting President Macron's appointment of the conservative Michel Barnier as the new prime minister, even though leftist parties won the most votes in July's snap parliamentary elections. This is the leader of the leftist Unbowed Party, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, speaking last week.
L'élection a donc été volée au peuple français.
And so the election has been stolen from the French people. The message has been denied, and now we're finding out about a prime minister that was named with the permission and maybe on the suggestion of the far-right national rally. Knowing that the second round of the legislative election has been entirely concentrated on making this national rally fail.
So that's Jean-Luc Mélenchon, head of Unbowed. You have the leftists winning, and the president, Macron, who called the snap election and yet lost it, giving the prime ministership to the right.
It's appalling, Amy. I mean, this is, you know, the sort of trend we see in most of the Western world, a very authoritarian approach to politics if they lose. And Jean-Luc Mélenchon was determined to fight. He created a new united front with the socialists and all progressive parties to make sure that the extreme right-wing party of Marine Le Pen was defeated. Macron had said before the election, let the far right come to power, they'll discredit themselves. Well, that didn't happen because of the campaign waged by La France Insoumise and Jean-Luc Mélenchon in particular. Effectively, they created a united front which defeated the far right, and this spoiled brat Macron, who came up from nowhere, you know, a sort of technocrat politician, now operates as if he's a statesman. I think he has discredited himself considerably. And we shall see. He had a meeting with the far right. He has not met Mélenchon once. He's made it clear that he's not going to appoint a president from the group or the bloc which got the largest votes. And this is the trend I was referring to earlier. If they feel they can get away with anything. And there have been demonstrations, there have been a few strikes as well, but there's been no big protest from the so-called international community, i.e. the State Department in D.C. You know, no protest from Foggy Bottom at all that this is intolerable behavior, because, you know, they tolerate it when their own allies do it. How it's going to turn out for Macron, we shall see. I think there is now 52% voted for his impeachment. I mean, in opinion polls, 52% of French people said that Macron should be prosecuted and impeached. So he's divided the country quite sharply. So we'll see what he does. I mean, Barnier is a joke figure. He got 4% of the vote and he's been appointed prime minister. I mean, what's needed in France, actually, to be serious, is an abolition of this Fifth Republic that was created by de Gaulle after he seized power as a general in 1958. And it was designed to give the president maximum powers. It's not a democratic state, you know, in any sense of the word. The democracy has tried to push through it. And so we need a new republic. And, you know, Mélenchon has been arguing, and many of us have been, let's have elections to a constituent assembly to choose and draft a new constitution. We need a sixth republic in France, because the Fifth Republic has failed.
And Tariq, I wanted to ask you, though, across Europe, the extreme right wing, especially anti-immigrant parties, have been gaining strength, even though in Britain and France they've been beaten back. But even the center has become increasingly more anti-immigrant, anti-African, anti-Arab, in the United States, Latin American. What's your sense of the prospects for progressives and radicals to win popular support, given that sectors of the working class and the middle classes are falling prey to this anti-immigrant phobia?
Oh, and this is always the case at times of crisis, social, political, economic, that people from the working class and the middle class, as you called it here, get carried away. It's a simple propaganda. We don't have enough jobs. We don't have enough money. Look at these people coming from outside. Well, in Europe, you can say that. But in the United States, as I always point out, everyone has come from the outside except Native Americans. So what is the big deal that, you know, you now just want to exclude people of color? In Europe, of course, they went and searched for workers all over the former colonies, because after the Second World War, there's a big shortage of labor. And what they did effectively was to go and plead with West Indian black nurses to come and run the British National Health Service, for workers to come and run the factories. And this is a population which they're now targeting. But the most reprehensible feature of this, as you point out, is that mainstream politicians have not managed to frontally take on these arguments. In fact, in the new Labour government, you have politicians sort of slyly saying, well, yes, there are problems. We have too many immigrants. Labour is working very hard to try and stop the flow. And the result of this is illegal gangs promising migrants in poverty-stricken countries or countries where you have large numbers of people dislodged by wars, as we see in the Middle East today and as we've seen for the last 5 or 6 years, who want to come and seek refuge. And they're being denied entry into the countries which have made these wars. And in effect, many of them are drowning in boats in the English Channel, just dropping dead, being pushed out by unscrupulous gangsters who promise them that they'll get them in illegally. So it's a really grim situation on that front. And this is now in Germany, too, that in recent state elections in the former Eastern Germany, Thuringia, the far-right party, AfD, won the largest vote. I mean, you know, they can still be outvoted, but they won a large vote. And this is spreading in other parts of Germany, too, which also takes in the fact that some of these far-right groups are saying, why are we backing a war with Russia? Why are we supporting Ukraine? It's not in our national interest. Why are we following the Americans? So it's immigration and a lot of other issues actually being tied together by these parties. And the extreme center governments, center left and center right, do nothing. They're actually provoking this by doing nothing at all.
Well, Tariq Ali, we want to thank you for being with us and in our studio. We look forward to having you back to talk about your memoirs when they are released. Tariq Ali is a British-Pakistani historian, activist, filmmaker, editor of the New Left Review, the author of over 50 books, including the forthcoming You Can't Please All, Memoirs 1980 to 2024, in from London here in New York City. Coming up, as the official death toll in Gaza tops 41,000, we talked to former U.S. presidential candidate Ralph Nader about how the current death toll that is being repeated around the world may be a vast undercount. We'll also be speaking with him about the upcoming debate, maybe the only one, between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. Stay with us.
So soon on the Dunbar end,
everyone sighed
when strangers became your new best friends.
Everyone sighed.
It was Armistice Day and peace broke out.
Everyone sighed.
Sometimes a melody is louder than a shout.
Everyone sighed.
Somebody struck up a song. We didn't know the words, but still we sang them.
That's All by Chumbawamba here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We continue to look at Israel's war on Gaza, where the official death toll has topped 41,000 Palestinians. So that could be a vast undercount that doesn't include those remain trapped in the rubble and the people and children who've died due to chronic illnesses, infectious diseases spreading across Gaza. Over the past 11 months, Israel's destroyed Gaza's health system and other crucial infrastructure, placed a blockade on medications and other urgent aid. More than 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza also risk imminent famine, with children starving at a record rate. The UN's humanitarian aid chief, Martin Griffiths, has said life is draining out of Gaza at terrifying speed, unquote. Even some Biden administration officials have admitted the Gaza death toll could be significantly higher. This is Barbara Leaf, Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, speaking last November.
In this period of conflict and conditions of war, it is very difficult for any of us to assess what the rate of casualties are. We think they're very high, frankly, and it could be that they're even higher than are being cited. We'll know only after the guns fall silent. So we take in sourcing from a variety of folks who are on the ground, and so I can't stipulate to one figure or another, but I think it's very possible that they're even higher than is being reported.
That was Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs Barbara Leaf. The prestigious British medical journal Lancet has estimated the actual death toll could be 186,000 or even higher, roughly 8% of Gaza's population. The report looks at how war leads to indirect deaths due to shortages of medical care, food, shelter, and water. This all comes as protests continue, demanding the U.S. government immediately halt its military aid to Israel and calling on Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris, who's debating Donald Trump tonight in Philadelphia, to shift her policies on Gaza. For more, we go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Ralph Nader, longtime consumer advocate, corporate critic, former presidential candidate. Four times. He's the author of many books, including most recently, Let's Start the Revolution, Tools for Displacing the Corporate State and Building a Country that Works for the People. Ralph Nader is the founder of the monthly print-only newspaper, Capitol Hill Citizen, where his front page article on the latest issue is headlined Exposing the Gaza Death Undercount. Ralph, in a moment, we want to talk to you about the debate tonight and talk about the Democratic and Republican parties' approach to, as you talk about, the corporate state. But let's start with this undercount. What you are saying is so much higher, the death toll in Gaza, than what we understand.
Hello?
Hi, Ralph. Can you hear me? It sounds like Ralph Nader can't hear us. Ralph, are you there? We're going to go to, well, why don't we go to our last segment, which is James Earl Jones, who just died at the age of 93, reading in a Voices of the People's History of the United States performance, the words of Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist, the former enslaved person. He is reading from Voices of a People's History of the United States by the late great historian Howard Zinn.
Frederick Douglass, once a slave, became a brilliant and powerful leader of the anti-slavery movement. In 1852, he was asked to speak in celebration of the 4th of July.
Fellow citizens, pardon me, and allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I, or those I represent, to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us? And am I, therefore, called upon to bring our humble offering to the national altar and to confess the benefits? and express devout gratitude for the blessings resulting from your independence to us, I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. The sunlight that brought life and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice, I must mourn. To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated temple of liberty and call upon him to join you in joyous anthems were inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak today? What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days of the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is a constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham. Your boasted liberty, an unholy license. Your national greatness, swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciation of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy, a thin veil to cover up crimes that would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation of the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of these United States at this very hour. At a time like this, scorching irony, not convincing argument, is needed. Oh, had I the ability and could reach the nation's ear, I would today pour forth a stream, a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened. The conscience of the nation must be roused. The propriety of the nation must be startled. The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed, and the crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced.
That was James Earl Jones reading the words of Frederick Douglass' speech, What to the Slave is Your 4th of July. That was during a performance of Voices of a People's History of the United States, which was co-edited by the late great historian Howard Zinn. James Earl Jones, famous for his booming voice as a child, stuttered so badly that for years he chose almost not to speak at all. James Earl Jones has died at the age of 93. We turn now back to Ralph Nader, longtime consumer advocate, corporate critic, former presidential candidate, founder of the monthly print-only newspaper, The Capitol Hill Citizen. His front page piece in the current edition is headlined Exposing the Gaza Death Undercount. Ralph, why don't you lay out for us why you don't believe the count is, what are we at this point, something like 41,000 dead, more than 16,000 of them Palestinian children, Ralph?
Amy, this is a horrifyingly undercount, and it has political rationale for it. If the true count was known, it would devastate the mythology that the Biden administration and Congress are furthering, that the Israeli government does not purposely target civilian populations and therefore violate all kinds of U.S. laws conditioning the shipment of weapons to Israel and international laws. So I put together in this article in the Capital Citizen, people can go to capitalcitizen.com and get it, the various probative evidence that shows that experts who are blocked from getting additional data that the State Department has and is keeping secret, that the evidence shows that it's well over 300,000, and it may double by the end of the year. In an article in The Guardian by the distinguished chair of global public health at the University of Edinburgh, titled Scientists Are Closing In on the True Horrifying Scale of Death and Disease in Gaza, she estimates over 300,000 before the end of the year, pointing out with the Lancet report that you mentioned that the Lancet people used a very, quote, used a very conservative estimate, but allowed that the number could easily be much higher. And so why is this happening? Why are all sides, the anti-genocide side, Israeli, the Hamas, why are they always using these figures? Because for different reasons, it serves their political purposes. Hamas doesn't want the true count to be known because it will be assailed by its own people and its international allies as unable to protect its own people and provide shelters. Netanyahu, of course, wants it lowballed for obvious reasons, and Biden for the same a reason. So what do these scientists see? They see a tiny enclave, the geographical size of Philadelphia, with 2.3 million people, crowded, already sick and destitute from years of Israeli illegal embargoes, high levels of anemia among the children before October 7th. And then starting October 8th, the Israeli military issued the genocidal orders of no food, no water, no medicine, no electricity, no fuel. And they proceeded accordingly. And so what these scientists are seeing are what's called the empirical evidence that people on social media are seeing and others. With over 130,000 bombs and missiles, plus daily tank shelling, ruthless sniper fire, there's been massive destruction of apartment buildings, congested marketplaces, refugee camps, hospitals, over 150 health clinics, masses of families huddled in schools being blown up, ambulance being blown up, bakeries destroyed, schools, universities, mosques, churches, roads, electricity networks, critical water mains, just about everyone and everything. And some people, partisans of Netanyahu, will say, oh, the Israeli government never targets civilians. Historically, they've always targeted civilians. Go back to the early 80s when former Israeli ambassador and foreign minister Abba Iban wrote of Israel under then Prime Minister Menachem Begin that Israel, and I'm quoting him, quote, is wantonly inflicting every possible measure of death and anguish on civilian populations in a mood reminiscent of regimes which neither Mr. Begin nor I would dare to mention by name, end quote. And just a few years earlier, in the late 70s, Israel's leading military analyst, summing up remarks by the Israeli chief of staff, stated the following. quote, the Israeli army has always struck civilian populations, purposefully and consciously. The army has never distinguished civilian from military targets, but purposely attacked civilian targets, end quote. And why is this important? Because to this day, all of the administration's spokespeople are denying that Israel has targeted civilians, denying that Israel has violated international genocide laws, denying that they have violated six federal statutes conditioning shipment of weapons to foreign countries on recognizing human rights excessively. To this administration and to the Congress, all deaths of civilians are accidental. Blowing up schools, sheltering refugees, well, that was a mistake. So that's why it's important, Amy, and Juan, to get that estimate as reliably high as possible. We are seeing possibly a million deaths before the end of the year. We have starvation, we have infectious diseases. All the doctors that you've had on Democracy Now! Have provided the clinical evidence of what's going on. 5,000 babies born every month into the rubble, contaminated water, horrific air pollution with heavy metals from the bombing, and no food. We're led to believe by these 41,000 figures that 98% or more of the is a Palestinian population still alive? I mean, what are they made of, asbestos and steel? And as the doctors have said on your program, when they went back to the rubble and the broken hospitals, they didn't meet anybody in Gaza who wasn't sick or injured. There's an interview in February in Al Jazeera by a Gaza undertaker who's doing this free of charge, and crying every day with his assistants on the open graves. He says he's buried 17,000 bodies, including 800 in one day, and that was back in February.
Ralph, I wanted to ask you, in addition to the bombings and the killings of civilians, Israel has also refused to allow foreign press to come into Gaza and has systematically been killing those journalists, those Palestinians within Gaza who are reporting. Talk about this attack on the press that really has not gotten much of much outrage in the West.
Yeah, I mean, how weak can you get as a president of the United States or member of Congress when you can't even demand that Netanyahu let foreign and Israeli journalists, including U.S. journalists, into Gaza to freely report? He's been blocking this for years, and Israeli military is targeted, as you indicated, Palestinian journalists. They've killed over 165 of them, including, in addition to members of their own family, targeting apartments, for example. They've killed over 200 members of UNRWA, the UN relief. They're out to destroy every relief center, every food feeding center of UNRWA, education center. Right now, let's put it in comparative terms here. More Palestinians have been killed since October 8th than have been killed by the U.S. in Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and Dresden. Now, that total death toll was about 240,000 people. And those deaths were in countries, Germany and Japan, with 160 million population. Here we only have 2.3 million population. And all you got to do is read the Israeli press, read Haaretz, read the statements by 17
seconds,
Israeli
Ralph.
Human rights groups.
Ralph Nader, we want to thank you for being with us. Longtime consumer advocate, corporate critic, four-time former presidential candidate. We'll link to your article in the Capitol Hill Citizen, Exposing the Gaza Death Undercount. That does it for our show. Watch tonight's debate between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Sego.
Buju. Anin.
Tansay.
Hey,
Arts and culture weaves conversations with indigenous language and knowledge keepers to learn, celebrate, and connect. Join us as we delve into distinct indigenous language families, beginning in February.
Broadcasting on the internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.